Chapter 13. We then visited the Peruvians' mint to see them make and stamp their coin. In the center of their stamping room was a pit about 6 feet deep and about 5 in diameter. In the center of the bottom of this was the foundation, in which was the lower pintle of the standard on which the money was laid or held to be stamped. The stamping machine was fashioned at the top like a common capstan, with holes pierced through to receive 2 long levers or bars over 20 feet long with a man stationed at each end of the bar. From the head of the capstan it tapered down to a point on which was fixed the stamp. One man in the pit with a half bushel of silver pieces to be stamped for half dollars or quarters, as the case may be, holds each piece between his thumb and forefinger on the bottom pintle. The stamp was on the bottom of the capstan, about 1 foot above his fingers. The men would lay hold of the end of the capstan bars and whirl the capstan halfway round, when it would stamp the silver with a crash and fly back with a spring to its place, where the 4 men would seize the bars again and whirl it back, and another piece was coined. In this way, they stamped several pieces in a minute. We were told that the stamp came down every time with about 7 tons weight. The stamp was now prepared to coin 6 pences. I watched the men in the pit to see how he could hold these small pieces within, as it were, a hair's breadth of the stamp, which came down with 7 tons weight several times a minute, or about as fast as he could place the uncoined pieces under the stamp. The man seemed to be perfectly at home in this business and accomplished his work with as much ease as a seamstress would stitch a garment. "Because he's used to it," says one. "But if he had lost his thumb and forefinger before he got used to it, how then?" The wonder to me was how a man could get used to such a hazardous business without getting his fingers pinched. These Peruvians were Roman Catholics, and had some 60 Catholic churches within the walls of their city, mostly built of stone and brick. Many of them were very costly, covering acres of ground, with beautiful gardens in the center plots, with so many apartments that it was necessary for strangers to employ a guide to prevent losing their way. Most splendid paintings and costly images of the saints could be seen in various apartments, with living beings kneeling before them, crossing themselves and moving their lips, as in the act of prayer. In many of their churches, particularly the place assigned for public worship, the supporting columns sustaining the heavy arched work were plated with silver. Their richly ornamented altars were studded with large golden horns, but the patriots were stripping off the gold and silver and coining it in their mint to pay off their armies. Their feast days were numerous. They had saints and All Saints' days, but the most important feast that I witnessed in the church was the Imitation of Jesus and his disciples at the last Passover and supper. A large table near the center of the church might be seen loaded with silver dishes, pitchers, silver plates, knives, forks, etc. Then Jesus and the 12 apostles, as large as life, were all seated in order around the table, gorgeously dressed with silver steeple top caps on their heads. The people, as they crowded in, dropped upon their knees all around them, apparently awestruck with the imposing sight. While they were worshiping in their accustomed attitude, the officers were in pursuit of us, Protestant strangers, requesting us also to kneel. We were so anxious to see how this feast was conducted that we kept moving and changing our position, until so closely pursued and required to kneel that we passed out and visited other churches which were also open on this occasion. Some of their churches are furnished with many bells, and when occasion requires them all to be rung at once, hardly anything else can be heard. After my arrival in the city, I was standing in the street conversing with friends when the bells began to strike a slow funeral tone. All business ceased in a moment. Carriages and all moving vehicles stopped. Men, women, and children, no matter what were their engagements or how interesting their conversation, ceased to speak. Men on horseback dismount and every man, with his head uncovered, respectfully waits for 1 or 2 minutes when the solemn tone of the bells changes to a joyous ringing. Then business of all kinds was resumed, and the people moved on again with their heads covered as they were before the bells struck. This was at the setting of the sun. I asked my Spanish friend, who appeared to be very devout during the ceremony, the meaning of this. "Why," said he, "that all the people may remember God at the close of the day." I thought, surely this was a most respectful ceremony, worthy of universal imitation. Yet after all, this people were living in continual violation of the second commandment of God. Their priests did not hesitate to visit gambling rooms and play billiards on Sunday, as on other days. When the Roman Catholics suppressed the Inquisition, there was a noted one in the city of Lima, which occupied a large space of ground. The Peruvians not only suppressed this diabolical institution at that time, but they demolished the huge pile of buildings and left it in a heap of ruins except one of the courtrooms, where the implements of torture had been arranged for the cruel work of torturing heretics. We saw a number of places where the walls had been broken away in this room, and were told that these were places where the implements of torture had been removed. Some old-fashioned lead inkstands on the desks were left by the mob. We were also shown some of the dismal dungeons that were beneath the ruins underground. In one corner we noticed a bed of earth stoned up a few feet above the wet ground for the prisoner's bed. We were pointed also to some recesses that were still standing. These were to torture heretics, and built just large enough for a person to stand upright with his hands down and a door fastened against him, a position that a person could live in but a very short time. But we forbear to speak further at this time of these so-called Christian institutions of the Roman Catholic Church, instituted and nourished for centuries by the papacy, granting power to her bishops and priests to punish and put to death what they called heretics, by all kinds of torture that fiends in human shape could invent. We took on board a number of passengers at Cayo to land in Trujillo in latitude 8 degrees south. Here we sold the Chatsworth for $10,000 to a Spanish merchant. $7,000 were in lumps and pieces of platypina and virgin silver to be paid here. As this and all gold and silver coin was prohibited from exportation by the Peruvian government, various measures were invented by foreigners and their vessels. As my agreement was that the silver should be delivered to me outside of the breakers on board the sea, when the time arrived for me to leave for Lima, I asked how this money was to be delivered. Said the merchant, "It will come off to you about midnight tonight." "But how?" said I. "We will send it to you by some Indians," that is, aborigines. I asked if the money was to be counted out to me before I left the shore, that I might identify the same and the number of pieces as per invoice rendered when brought off to me. The merchant replied that he had put the amount of silver specified in the invoice into the hands of several Indians many weeks before, subject to his order. Said I, "What did they do with it?" "Oh, they buried it up in the ground somewhere." "Do you know where?" "No." "What security have you from them that they will keep it for you?" "None," said he. "Well, how do you know that they will deliver it all to me tonight?" Said he, "I have employed them a great while and put into their hands thousands of dollars in this way and paid them well for their labor when they delivered what I entrusted with them. And there has never been any failure on their part, and I fear none. They are the most honest people in the world, particularly where they live separate by themselves." The Chatsworth lay some 2 miles from shore. The breakers inshore of us were too dangerous for ships' boats to pass. The government used a large boat manned with 16 oars by Indians trained for the business, and when occasion required her to pass out to the shipping or return back through these dangerous breakings of the sea, another company of Indians standing on the shore as soon as the boat approaches the breakers on her way out and they discover the sea rising to break over her, would make a most hideous yell. the boatmen would instantly head their boat for the breakers and take a position with their oars to obey the helmsman's orders to keep their boat headed directly to the sea, while she was being violently tossed by the breakers, and then they would pull for life to clear the sandbar before another sea came. When the boat was returning, and they heard the watchman's yell, the helmsman would steer the boat square before the rolling breakers, the oarsmen pulling with all their strength. After two or three struggles, the danger was past. The watchman on the shore would raise a mighty joyous shout, joined by the boatmen, announcing to all around, "All's well." The people here, and in other places on the coast, have another kind of boat they call caballos, or horses, on which they ride as people do on horseback. These horses are made of the common tall flags or rushes securely lashed together, about 10 feet long, the large part about 2 feet in diameter, tapering to 2 inches at the small end. This end they turned up like the head of a boat to stand prominent out of the water which cuts through the sea. The large part is to ride on. None but those that were well trained could ride these kind of horses or keep them right side up but a few moments at a time. The people, especially the Indians, would move through the water in a masterly manner, even much faster than a common boat with a double paddle or the paddle blade fitted at both ends, seated as on horseback. It was interesting to see them paddle alternately on each side of the breakers, and when about to pass them, lie down on their horse while the breakers washed over them, and then paddle clear before the next one came. I was told that this kind of horses was of great importance on some parts of the coast, where the breakers would not admit a ship's boat to approach. Communications and dispatches were there made through the medium of these caballos, or Spanish horses. The Indians that were to convey the Platypina to us had to pass through this dangerous place in the dark night while their watchmen on the shore were waiting in suspense and deep anxiety their safe return. When we set the watch at night, I requested my brother, the chief mate, to be on deck until midnight, and if he saw anyone floating on the water approaching us, to call me up. About midnight he called me, saying, "There are two men alongside sitting in the water." We lowered down empty water buckets and a lighted lantern when the Indians unfastened the bags of silver that were securely hung with lines underneath their caballos and placed them in the buckets for us to haul up on deck. When it was all safely aboard, they seemed very much pleased at the accomplishment of the job. It appeared to me at that season of the night about an impossibility for them to pass through those dangerous breakers. We gave them some refreshment as they sat on their water horses, for they dared not leave them, but soon moved away as fast as possible to relieve their waiting comrades on the shore and to receive the compensation that their employer had promised them. As their employer had declared, every particle was delivered to me as per invoice. I now delivered up the Chatsworth to the purchaser, took leave of my officers and crew, my brother succeeding me in the command of the sea, the second officer succeeding him as chief mate, to remain in the employ of the new owners to trade in the Pacific Ocean. I then took passage to Lima on board a Peruvian schooner. I was aware that I was risking much in the hands of this stranger and his crew, who might think that the large amount of money placed in their hands was of more value to them than my life. But I had no other means of conveyance to Lima. I endeavored to manifest no fear nor lack of confidence in him as a gentleman, but watched him very closely and endeavored to keep the run of his vessel and course steered. We anchored in Cayo Bay after a passage of 7 days. Here he refused to deliver me the $7,000 in silver which I had placed in his care until our arrival at Cayo, alleging that the government of Peru did not allow him to deliver it to me. This he well understood when I placed it in his care to deliver it to me on our arrival in Cayo. He also knew that if he reported any specie on board belonging to a foreigner, no matter how honestly he came by it, the government would seize it for their own use. As the matter stood, he would neither let me have it nor let the government know there was any silver on board his vessel. He then immediately cleared for another country, weighed his anchor, and proceeded to sea. I soon learned of his dishonest and wicked intentions. I was at that time on board of a New Bedford whale ship and saw him under way. Captain H. manned his whaleboat, and we soon overtook him. He still refused to deliver me the silver until he saw that resistance was vain. He then very reluctantly allowed me to receive it and continued on his voyage. We transferred the silver to the United States ship Franklin 74, Commodore Stewart commanding, on deposit until we were ready for sea, as other Americans had to do for safekeeping. Mr. Swinegar, our Peruvian merchant, gave a large dinner party to the captains and supercargoes of the American squadron, February 22, in honor of General Washington's birthday. As I was the only person at the table that had decided not to drink wine or strong drink because of its intoxicating qualities, Mr. S. stated to some of his friends with him at the table that he would influence me to drink wine with him. He filled his glass and challenged me to drink a glass of wine with him. I responded by filling my glass with water. He refused to drink unless I filled with wine. I said, "Mr. Swinegar, I cannot do so, for I have fully decided never to drink wine." By this time the company were all looking at us. Mr. S. still waited for me to fill my glass with wine. Several urged me to comply with his request. One of the lieutenants of the squadron, some distance down the table, said, "Bates, surely you will not object to take a glass of wine with Mr. Swinegar?" I replied that I could not do it. I felt embarrassed and sorry that such a cheerful company should be so intent on my drinking a glass of wine as almost to forget the good dinner that was before them. Mr. S., seeing that I would not be prevailed on to drink wine, pressed me no further. At that time my deep convictions with respect to smoking cigars enabled me to decide also that from and after that evening I would never smoke tobacco in any way. This victory raised my feelings and elevated my mind above the fog of tobacco smoke, which had to a considerable extent beclouded my mind and freed me from an idol which I had learned to worship among sailors.